Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody. Here today with our review of Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
A.K.A. in marketing materials, Harley Quinn in Birds of Prey, A.K.A. Pete, since Sunday, on movie ticket sales websites, Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey. Not too bad for a movie that's been out for 5 days.
And I think we need to calm some of the frayed nerves surrounding this movie. We're going to talk about the financials in a little bit. But we attended a 6 p.m. showing on Thursday, February 6th. We bought tickets the day they were available, I want to say maybe 10 days before, because it had screened and people were beginning to talk about it. And I remember there being a lot of buzz when it was announced, and then you had the first trailer, and it got very, very quiet. But I think I can speak for Matt in that we both had a pretty good time at the movies.
Oh, this movie is a ton of fun. This movie is a home run creatively, visually, in terms of acting. Is it Black Panther? No, it is not. Is it The Dark Knight? No, it is not. Nor does it aim to be. This is just a wild, fun time. This is, Pete, why people go to the movies for movies like this, despite the fact that we were warned that it would emasculate us to see so many women doing empowered things on the screen. Turns out, Pete, we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, and of course there is the backlash that there were empty theaters. There weren't. There have been circulated videos, all strangely filmed by threatened males, of empty theaters for showings. Very little proof offered that these are showings for the film. And critically, the film has met with a positive reaction. I've not talked to a person who's seen it yet who has not liked it.
Yeah, and let's dig into those numbers a little bit, Pete. For its opening weekend, $81 million worldwide, 35 in the U.S., 46 international. Definitely soft, definitely below what was forecast. But Pete, this is a movie that cost about $85 million. So to say it's the worst opening of the DCEU, I mean, that is financially true. It's also entirely possible, Justice League may not have made a profit because it was so darned expensive. This movie, this movie will do just fine. Thank you very much.
And I think that it's on its way to doing that. It doesn't need to recoup its budget in the first weekend. They're halfway there, approximately. And I think they're going to be fine. And I think, like a Solo, this movie is going to find its legs over time being better than the opening. I mean, for a universe that has been as disjointed as the DC extended universe that the past couple movies has kind of seemed to find itself after the awful Justice League debacle. Aquaman is a super solid popcorn action movie. We enjoyed Shazam enough. This the bridge here to really their linchpin at this point in Wonder Woman come summer, something I'm really looking forward to this year. And to embrace what in the past has been their murderverse and to do it with Harley Quinn, I think all around was the right decision. And I stand by this film.
What has been the Marvel success for these 10 years? It's all connected. It's been a shifting formula of sorts, but kind of basically a certain Marvel formula. Certainly some hard bumpers in terms of not going to do rated R, not going to do anything that's too controversial to the brand, to the larger brand, etc. What has DC and Warner Brothers found in the last three films, which is to say Aquaman, Shazam, and now Harley Quinn in Birds of Prey, a.k.a. Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey, a.k.a. Birds of Prey. It's kind of disconnect the movies, don't set up the next thing, concentrate on telling this particular story, don't worry about the sequel to the sequel, and go out there and hit a home run, which I think a lot of that is baked into the Marvel formula as well, but... You know, these last three movies have been exactly what they promised. This one, of course, the first rated R one, you know, I think a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking in terms of did that do financial justice to the film in terms of Harley Quinn as a character skewing younger, and you're excluding some of those, you know, some of those younger audience members, younger women in particular. I think there's some financial sense to that. However, you know, this is a solidly R-rated movie for language and violence. You know, it's not Saw in terms of violence, but, you know, this is a solidly rated R movie. They made the movie that they set out to make, and I think it's a better movie as a result of it as a movie. You want to say, okay, as a product, it has a weird title that clearly was mismarketed, and now they figured out on Sunday that the thing was mismarketed. Okay, those are business concerns. The creative movie that they wanted to make, they made.
And that's just the thing. I think to have this non-linear madcap storytelling from writer Christina Hodson, and she brought us Bumblebee a little while ago, and then you have a director and former journalist, Kathy Yan, who really captured the spirit of this character. I mean, Margot Robbie went out, she pitched this a number of times. She was adamant the character does not work well alone. It should not be Harley Quinn, the movie. And again, I think the informed audience would support that. So to build this team of other characters, some more known than others, around her as the really pivotal presence, you know, to give her this producer nod as this cartoon character come to life, more so than Suicide Squad. And what are you doing here? It's the solo effort, but it's a team movie. She'll be in the true team movie like she was in the team movie before in the upcoming Suicide Squad sequel. The Suicide Squad, right, Matt?
Pete, listen, if you thought this Harley Quinn movie was confusingly titled Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, which then has now been marketed under two separate titles, if you thought that was confusing, the second Suicide Squad movie is going to be called The Suicide Squad, you know, to differentiate it from Suicide Squad. So... I look forward to that Monday morning quarterbacking when that occurs.
And, you know, again, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think we left that movie on Thursday night, you know, sitting through the credits because a little something there. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But just so impressed on a movie that had some buzz, but not tremendous enough that we wanted to check it out ahead of time. And of course the trolls were out there attempting to harm this film, no doubt, you know, taking pleasure that it did not run away with the weekend. But again, I think long-term this movie is successful.
And I mean, you mentioned the trolls. Here's the antithesis to the trolls. 5 out of 7 of the cast members are women. As you mentioned, Pete, the writer, Christina Hodson, a female, directed by the female Kathy Yan. And then 2 of the 3 producers who have the producer's mark, that's the PGA after their name, and that is not something you can randomly put there. You need to prove that you were a major producer for it. There's a limit to the number of people per movie who can have that. That's a very, very vetted thing. 2 of those 3 producers of the film that had the producer's mark were women. So, gee whiz, Pete, we got a movie that was non-formulaic and broke all the rules and was effervescent and powerful and lovely because a bunch of women got together and made it. And P.S. made it at a lower budget, made it somewhat fail-proof in terms of, okay, the box office hasn't been great. It still is going to make money.
And I don't know really what critics of this would be expecting. It was not going to be a Tarantino movie in terms of violence and, you know, artistic measure. But for what it is, a comic book movie, I mean, lined up against all those other DC movies in this current universe incarnation, it's a more successful movie at storytelling than Man of Steel. I'll take this thing in a heartbeat over Batman v Superman. Is it as good as Wonder Woman? I think Wonder Woman remains their gold standard to this point. I liked it a little bit more than Aquaman. I definitely liked it more than Shazam. Justice League, you're not invited to this comparison.
I think that this is a very able sidequel to Suicide Squad, aka Suicide Squad 1. I will never be able to separate my viewing experience of Suicide Squad from the knowledge that it had been cut up and reshot and that we were seeing two related but different movies that were forced together.
Enchantress.
Indeed. This movie does not suffer from that. Again, I think lower budget and more focused production led to them making the movie that they wanted to make. But the best parts of Suicide Squad, where things are wild and crazy and just frankly unlike anything you've ever seen, if that's, you know, if that's hyperbole, I mean it only a little bit as hyperbole. This captures that spirit, captures the Harley Quinn spirit, and, you know, it's just a ton of fun to see.
And I think what kicks the narrative off in this film is the most effective possible place to begin. And that's with separating Harley Quinn out of the shadow of the Joker. And when you consider that, you know, the weekend we're opening this film, Joker is vying for a Best Picture, didn't win it, shouldn't have won it. I've seen it. Matt has not. We made the strategic decision to not podcast it. Apart from the fact that it is not in this universe, that Joker origin is not the Joker character that Harley Quinn breaks up with, who goes unseen in this film and best goes unseen in this film.
Well, unseen asterisk, we have one or two shots where there is a person dressed up as the Joker and he is out of focus. I think we also, not even I think, I'm sure that we also get an over-the-shoulder shot, over Jared Leto's shoulder shot from Suicide Squad. So, you know, is there Joker on the screen? Yes. Can you see his face? No. But as you say, Pete, best of all is that real early on, they make it clear that, you know, this is not a Harley Quinn and the Joker and the Emancipation of the Birds of Prey, new title, fourth title, you know, it's just... We're fast forwarding through this to get to her emancipation and to her being front and center in this film, and we're going to race there as soon as we can.
And I love what they do. They literally blow up the cementing of their relationship. The Acme chemical plant, her jumping into the chemicals. Why? To prove she loves him. So it's the ultimate statement that she is in charge of her own decisions, that she has the agency, and really sets the vibe for the rest of the film.
And echoes again, I think, a little bit of Suicide Squad early on, where she's interacting with a whole bunch of people, and they carried on a bit later as well, but, you know, kind of where they have titles and text on screen and whatnot. And soon enough, that's how we meet Bruce the Hyena, which, Pete, I didn't know I needed Bruce the Hyena in my cinematic life, but I am richer for it.
Named, of course, for Bruce Wayne. And there's, again, a little bit of that carryover from the previous appearance of Robbie's Harley Quinn. But yeah, it's just crazy enough. It's cute at the same time. You can't help but root for Harley Quinn. And can we just talk about the costuming for a second? You know, the iconic scene from this film thus far is Robbie walking away from what no doubt is a green screen explosion of the chemical plant. But, you know, the arms on her outfit, the kind of flashy confetti-esque thing going on. We can't say it because of our Apple Podcast rating that we want to maintain, but Rosie Perez's shirt later on in the film, maybe one of the biggest laughs.
I look forward to seeing that shirt at New York Comic Con and other
yes.
things. And it'll get laughs, but it'll be completely understood by people wearing it, by people who see it being worn.
And Renee Montoya, I knew the character and seen her a number of times, but this is a character I was unaware of the really heights of popularity. This is a character that on like top 100 comic lists repeatedly occurs.
Yeah, and I mean, insofar as this movie had... This movie was like, okay, great, Harley Quinn solo, what do we do next? And as you said, Pete, this idea that she needs to be surrounded by other characters. I mean, the descendant Detective Montoya, you know, she's been lapped by her former police partner who now is her boss. And nobody believes her in this, you know, wild, crazy case, even in the world of Gotham / Philadelphia, because I think they filmed in Philadelphia, at least parts of it. But, you know, you immediately...
No, they filmed completely in Los Angeles.
Did they?
They did. They got a tax credit.
Wait, Pete, they got a tax credit.
Yeah, so, hence the further concern that this film didn't make money. First off, if you've listened to Fantastic Geek enough and know that any film... It's apart from a serious, serious bomb to suggest that this film will not at the very least break even. And then there's the ancillary, you know, Rosie Perez t-shirts. I mean, I'd buy one. I just can't wear it publicly.
but certainly I stand corrected there. Shot in LA, that's only going to bring the cost down, particularly with that tax credit. But, you know, she's a fantastic character. Add to it Black Canary, Dinah Lance, played by Journey Smollett-Bell. And she's another wonderful presence there. Further, Pete, not only, you know, is she projecting great power and, you know, sultry on screen and whatnot, I think a lot of her fights she did herself. There was just that visceral, you know, we were watching it live. I couldn't pause it, go back, whatever. But there were some scenes where it's like, it just felt real in a way where I think my brain on a subconscious level was picking up that, like, you know, that head, that face, that body just made real contact with a stunt guy. Okay, didn't knock his head off with her leg, but I think she's doing a lot of the work here herself.
And I think this is going to lead to a lot of other work. I was really, really impressed with what she brought to the screen. The power and the exhibition of that a little later on might be one of the film's weaker moments. But again, you're in a universe where there are metahumans, Matt, not inhumans. And okay, they've got to give you a little bit of the superhero stuff, even in an anti-hero film at some point.
We also have the pickpocket Cassandra Cain, played by Ella J. Basco, who, Pete, it's funny, neither of us knew tons and tons about this movie going in. You know, usually it's I've avoided spoilers and you've read everything, and we kind of were just like, all right, movie, you got us at the title, let's see. I was not expecting a young, foul-mouthed woman to be one of the highlights of the film, nay, indeed, on a certain level, to be one of the birds of prey, but... Darn if she didn't hit a home run with it.
And a character who at one point has been, linked with the Batwoman, Batgirl mantle. So whether or not, and again, the financials will in part dictate that, but whether or not this actress gets to reprise this role and where they potentially may take it. I mean, it's safe to say it's not in the forthcoming, the James Gunn, a Suicide Squad film, because that thing is just packed. And again, we'll get to that towards the end of this podcast in terms of cast and when to expect that. That's actually filming now. But really enjoyed what Ella J. Basco brought, and the energy, and again, the interweaving of these characters early on in that non-linear style.
We also have Mary Elizabeth Winstead playing the, is it the crossbow killer, Pete? Wait, what should we call her? Wait, who is she? Who is she? Who is she, Pete?
Well, I mean, she's the daughter of the family we have recapped for us expositionally, you know, in about the third post there that lead to the MacGuffin that we're looking for, the Bertinelli diamond, and that one of them survived and she gets trained, and she's come to get this revenge. And I just, first off, I love Mary Elizabeth Winstead. And, you know, she is an actress, I think, does not get enough work. And to get a profile role like this, I mean, yes, she's led movies on her own before. You know, she killed it in that third season of Fargo with Ewan McGregor. And that's a story maybe for a little bit later on in terms of their thing. But she... The dorkiness that she sells as this super lethal character, yet she's awkward. She's not had an adolescence. And to find this family that she needs in Harley Quinn and Montoya and Kane and Black Canary, and to still not quite fit in, but fit in. It really worked in her hands.
Well, Pete, let's connect the dots on our way to Ewan McGregor here. Mary Elizabeth Winstead was in season 3 of Fargo, as you said. So is Ewan McGregor. Ewan McGregor started filming that season, a dedicated family man to his wife of over 20 years, finished that season, no longer married, on the arm of Mary Elizabeth Winstead. And apparently, wouldn't you know it, Pete, things didn't quite last in that crazy world there. So
and they do not appear, shock, in a scene together in this movie.
Indeed. The characters are in the same scene, but The actors, I mean, they couldn't have been edited farther away from each other. You know, I mean, I have every expectation that they were not on the set together. And I think that's your expectation as well. Ewan McGregor playing Roman Sionis, the Black Mask. And this is one of the all-time great Batman villain performances, I will go so far as to say, because McGregor, I think that his acting sensibilities, and a very, very capable actor, don't get me wrong, but I think that he is unshackled by being, fine, he's the top-billed male, I don't know what the order is in the credits and whatnot. In terms of the juice of the movie, he's like fifth or sixth on the list, and I think that that just releases him to be manic when he needs to be manic, to be silly when he needs to be silly, and to really be an R-rated version of a Batman 1966 kind of villain, even down to, at various points, these shiny suits and things like that. It was a phenomenal performance out of him, and I have a ton of respect for him. After losing respect for him, what with the whole cheating on his wife business back during Fargo season 3, I have a ton of respect for him as an actor, that he's willing to not, you know, that it's not, you know, Margot Robbie, Ewan McGregor, Birds of Prey, also lower names, you know, that he's willing to be part of an ensemble. He's willing to ham it up a little bit and to be all these things. He was wonderful.
Yeah. And I really, really love that take. This could have been completely mishandled as, well, let's make Black Mask this universe's version of Bane, and let's make him, you know, super scary and everything there. No, he's this club owner. He's a goofball. He may or may not have been bisexual. And it really works in McGregor's hands. I mean, is he typecast at this point as having played Obi-Wan Kenobi? And thank goodness he didn't in the, he did in the prequels, because otherwise what would we really have? Probably. And what do you know? He's returning to the role at some point when they film that for Disney Plus. But, you know, this is more than a paycheck in his hands. And the way that it unfolds on top of that, you know, this is a performer who understands what the task is, yet at the same time brings it in every scene.
And I think someone who is picking up the story slack when Ewan McGregor is not in the scenes is Chris Messina, who plays Victor Zsasz. Victor Zsasz in this movie is a character that you are constantly on edge around. And, you know, I get it that a lot of that is the nature of the core character, but Messina just brings an extra layer of being frightening, even if he too has to be playing second fiddle or third fiddle. And oftentimes it's just, you know, I mean, he's named, don't get me wrong, but a lot of the time, what's his function in the scene? He's henchman number one. He's head honcho henchman, not, you know, oh, here's my difficult past. You know, there's passing reference to adding scars on his chest. And, you know, right. He's got the scars on his face.
He's, you know, one dimensional in that regard. And we're not going to build him up. Okay, he was at the Burton Alley massacre. He now works for, Sionis. He's not the driver. Okay. He's the one, he's got a close association with Sionis. He's the one who puts things together that his boss doesn't, to find out that, Harley Quinn and, Huntress and Canary, have this plot with the diamond and everything like that. And, it is what it needs to be.
So Pete, in addition to this having an animated interlude towards the beginning. Side note, that's part of your, you know, let's explain away the Joker by having us go into Harley Quinn's head to have animation. Also, tons of great, you know, stunts, great fights, and it's kind of what you want in an R-rated comic book movie. And maybe the best of these is the fun gun sequence.
Yeah, between the glitter and the confetti, and, you know, they had, like, the color run dust in there, and the first time you see it, and then again to back up and then give us story preload on that, it's over the top, and the second time it's a little bit more of a realistic take, but it's a lot of fun. It's what that character in Harley Quinn, you know, they check the boxes in this film, and rightly, you know, later on, they got to give you the oversized hammer that she's pictured with. They did the baseball bat in the other film that, you know, one of the other characters, totes a baseball bat in this one. But, you know, they deliver on who the character is.
And to my mind, the lengthy fight sequence towards the end, which we're going to have a lengthy fight sequence, it should be towards the end. Maybe it was a couple minutes long when you go from the buildup of all of Sionis's bad guys going into the funhouse, then the funhouse fight, then leaving it, then the car roller chase sequence, kind of all rolled into one. But it's a minor quibble to say they gave me too much dessert at the end of my movie. And I'll say, in terms of it feeling authentic and real, you know, having Huntress on the motorcycle pulling Harley Quinn on roller skates towards the car that's speeding away, there were moments where I was like, oh no, you're on roller skates, this is scary, you're gonna fall, you know, things like that, which just sold a reality that you don't necessarily get when it's like, you know, and I mean, obviously due in massive respect to Marvel, but like in this scene, we took the actor, put them in a cap so we could not have their hair against the green screen. Then later we did digital hair. Then we lit them, and then we did digital lighting so that they, you know, all so we could do a shot. So it's like person in space versus like this is a stunt woman on roller skates going really fast towards a car. It works.
When Harley Quinn frees Cassandra from the lockup at the police precinct, and they trigger the sprinklers, okay, then all the doors open, and I think the best reaction all night, my favorite part, is when she took the bat to this one guy's legs, and the directions in which they bent in slow motion. And that for me is the recurrent image I go back to with how much I enjoyed this film.
And all of that there is the strength towards the R rating. I mean, I think that 3 years ago, the pitch was, okay, Harley Quinn has a certain level of sparkle as a character. The star is really, really invested. We don't know that this is a major motion picture. Well, let's see. Over at Fox, they took all those things, called it Deadpool, gave it a modest budget, and went and hit a massive home run. We can hope to, you know, if we can hope to do half of that in terms of box office, let's kind of go with that as a model. And they did. And some of this, it's some of this R-rated violence. It's a little difficult to explain how seeing a guy have his legs beaten and twisted in a way that is, you know, that is not natural, in a way that probably would result in a limp for the rest of your life at best, and maybe amputation at worst in the real life. But in this movie, it's just a good bit of fun. That's unique. That's part of what makes this movie so charming.
There's very clearly a thirst for content with this character. I mean, when we attend Comic Cons, this has to be like one of the top three most cosplayed characters. And like you said, the actress is super invested, that she's out there pitching the film, which is unusual in terms of, you know, studio involvement and everything like that, and the direction in which it's going to go. And you look at all the principles they have. I mean, let's look around for a minute. Matt, right? Superman, right? They don't have Superman anymore. So Batman, they're redoing Batman. That's right. So, you know, we've talked before when we podcast these DCEU films that, all right, they've course corrected from some massive misjudgments early on. Say what you want about Suicide Squad, she is the best thing in it, hands down. I'm super excited, particularly in the hands of James Gunn, what the Suicide Squad sequel is going to look like. I'm really excited what they bring for Harley Quinn and what you allow, you know, Oscar nominee Margot Robbie to do with that character.
Pete, talk a little bit about the booby trap climax that brings this movie to such fervor.
One of my smaller complaints about this film is that how we have to have areas of Gotham that are either completely abandoned or ensconced in fog and whatnot. But this sequence really works. The art of the funhouse is really neat. That it was a one-time cash for Harley and the Joker. And, oh, hey, we're going to open up the closet and grab the... Oh, all the guns are gone. And they find some stuff someplace else. And that leads into the... you know, resumption of her roller identity in the team up with Huntress and some just crazy stunt work, you know, coming from the front of the car to the side of the car and into the window and everything like that. And we wind up on this pier and really 180 degrees from where I saw it going.
I think the pier in particular, so basic, but so well done in terms of they commit to wide shots for several seconds where you can see clearly people in the, you know, in shadows, then moving into the fog, and then you realize they are completely gone, and they kind of let that just occur in front of you. It's a good enough gimmick that there's holes in the pier, and you got to be careful where you step and things of that sort. And it's just a great buildup for tension, buildup for the final showdown. Pete, we have seen and podcasted so much where usually 99 times out of 100, I can pick out a Chekhov's gun. I can pick out a setup for something that's going to be used later. And they had underplayed the grenade so well. It was just perfect. You saw the grenade, but then, you know, 5-8 minutes later, they had a whole bunch of fight and kind of promptly forgot about it. And for that to be the tool by which Roman Sionis is defeated, and defeated rather unceremoniously, yes, it was just a perfect way to cap things off.
And for me, the second biggest highlight of the film, the biggest has to come at the hands of Harley Quinn, and to beat the crap out of a guy's leg repeatedly in the midst of a flooding lockup. That's the essence of that character. And here to have Cassandra be the one to pull the pin, to have Black Mask blow up, to not be mourned, to move on. Hey, it's time for Mexican food, and you got to pass that diamond.
Yeah, I mean, crass and silly and wonderful. Pete, they even had the smarts to bring back Bruce the Hyena. You know, had there been one story saying it would have been, oh man, you killed Harley Quinn's dog / hyena. But to just say, oh no, he was lost down there. Pete, it almost smacked of, you know, they realized towards the end of the shoot, hey, it doesn't feel right that we killed the dog. I don't know, just say we found him and then bring him back in the scene. Like, it just worked. It just landed. Part of it, you have this zany character. This isn't the zany Gotham that we've seen in the Tim Burton or the Joel Schumacher years. Nor is it, I mean, there's a different weirdness to Gotham in the Christopher Nolan films. And then, I mean, in Justice League, like, each Gotham feels a little bit different. Yeah. This feels, all right, fine, you've convinced me, I saw it, you know, that it was filmed in Los Angeles. This feels like a very pedestrian city with crazy people in it. And, of course, there'd be a convertible with a hyena and Harley Quinn driving it away at the end. That's just how they do it in this Gotham.
Yeah, and I think you buy all of it. You know, you mentioned those other versions of Gotham. You're not going to make the Gotham of the mid to early 90s of gigantic statues everywhere that helicopters fly into. I mean, it just would look silly. And grounded enough, not the super ultra gritty of Nolan's Gotham. You can't revisit that. But an energetic enough place to set the backdrop for this, you know, really zany yet lovable character. I mean, I have to say, past Wonder Woman, I mean, this for me, I think, is the most beloved character they have going right now.
I think that you're probably right, and I think that it's because the character is so beloved that hopefully it does well second weekend at the box office, has a great life in streaming and home video and all that. If nothing else, you know, with the character returning for the Suicide Squad, you know, that could be an opportunity to revisit the character in the cultural zeitgeist, whatever it might be. Because let's not forget, you know, as I said, she does drive off into the sunset at the end there. Pete, we can only hope that James Gunn brings back the one, the only Bruce the Hyena as well.
I hope. I mean, surely he's aware of what they've done here, that they're feeding this into that film. I mean, this a better Suicide Squad movie than Suicide Squad, with the Suicide Squad coming and Robbie headlining that, and just that bonkers cast. I mean, one name after another that seems more unlikely to possibly be in that film. I'm really interested to see what comes of that. Apart from the attention getting, I mean, okay, so Gunn suffers the cancel culture, the situation that went on there, penalty, and what happens. They hear out the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy. They ultimately bring him back for that, but he had moved up the slate at DC. All right, Disney, you're going to cut ties. Well, we're going to jump on this super talented guy who's had tremendous success with comic properties that were unknown for most of society as of 6 years ago. And now, I mean, as I hold my dog named Groot, that I'm still explaining to people what her name is. You know, he is the reason. So, you know, where can he take a Harley Quinn? Where can he take other characters associated with Suicide Squad that few people outside the hardcore comic book junkie are even aware of? Color me interested.
And with Wonder Woman 1984 coming up this summer, I mean, I guess, Pete, there's an alternate universe where the Wonder Woman sequel did not leave the November 2019 box office spot that it originally had, and then it is a big propelling ground for Birds of Prey. That's probably how they had planned it, and then it just didn't work out that way. But certainly plenty of promise there. You know, as much as we podcast Marvel stuff, we go where the good stuff is, and it's in Birds of Prey, it's in Wonder Woman 1984, it's hopefully in The Suicide Squad, and, you know, so much of that fun, that potential fun, is here in Birds of Prey.
I've said it before, I'll say it again. The rising tide raises all ships, and to have a successful DC comic, you know, extended, whatever we're going to call it, universe. I know they shy away from that terminology. It helps everybody. And we want to see characters. I mean, geez, Matt, should they ever get Superman right? Is J.J. Abrams meeting right now about a new Superman film, about finally correcting the ills of, you know, the trite and just terrible storytelling with, I mean, can we say the most popular superhero of all time, that somehow Zack Snyder just completely managed to bungle? Oh, by the way, I am Clark Kent, reporter.
Well, I mean, there are these stories, you know, in the last 6 months of Warner Brothers saying, what can we do to make the Superman character relevant? I mean, this immigrant who's a journalist and who's principled, going up against the big business corrupt Lex Luthor, I don't know what we can do with it, you know. Maybe it does take somebody with the independence of a J.J. Abrams or similar to go, no, I'm making my movie, you know, I'm kind of somewhat studio proof. I don't know. I mean, maybe the future with, I mean, look, we're all settling into, all right, I have the streamers that I have now and I'm settled. I'm not really that interested in paying for the Peacock. I'm not interested in paying for HBO Max. And I'm not that, you know, but all it's going to take is, oh my goodness, Pete, you need to see this Superman series on HBO Max, which I'm making up in my head. You know, all it takes is that. You sit and go, oh my goodness, it's Game of Thrones, but it's got that production value, but it's just hitting the emotional thing. It's reminding us, you know, corn-fed middle of America, real American values. It's doing it. Maybe that's the thing maybe that's the place to tell the story of a journalist who's an immigrant who believes in things like free press, you know, and ending corruption. Maybe that's the future. I don't know.
Well, I think until we get that, until we're bringing you Wonder Woman 1984, which we will podcast later this year, go see Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey, whatever it's called. Stay all the way through. There's no secret scene. However, there's a really good ha-ha that propels you from the theater, and I do not think it would be time or money wasted.
Pete, this entire podcast adventure brought to our listeners by those who go to patreon.com/fantasticgeek and help make sure that we have the bleeps and the bloops and the bandwidth and the storage and make it possible, even as we had some behind the scenes technical difficulties. They're the wind beneath our wings that keep us flying, even to Birds of Prey.
Everybody who contributes gets access to exclusive podcast content, all sorts of levels in there. Always looking to bring you things behind the scenes, but it only takes $1 a month, a measly quarter a week with all the other podcasts that we bring you, whether currently we're talking Star Trek Picard, God Friended Me returning this week. We're going to be bringing you Star Trek Discovery before we know it. All of the Marvel Cinematic Universe TV shows, even your Disney Plus ones that are coming, The Mandalorian, all of it paid for by our patrons to patreon.com/fantasticgeek.
And Pete, in addition to all that stuff you mentioned, Picard, God Friended Me, and whatnot, over on our Patreon page, maybe this weekend, we'll be talking about a movie, parts of which were shot in Italy and involved complaints about sand. Looking forward to that. A movie everyone's familiar with, especially our patrons who might pick up the clue based on what we did last month on Patreon only. But Pete, all sorts of goodies there on the Patreon page, including the one coming this weekend, in which, in order to cause trouble, somebody hires somebody to do a very poor job. But Pete, there's some goodies that are free. That's Talking to You on Twitter. How can people do so?
You find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J-K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 11,141 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast, comment on FantasticGeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with a P-H, all one word, like it today.
As mentioned before, everybody listening to this is listening on the Pop Culture Podcast feed, so we'll be back on Saturday with Picard and Monday for God Friended Me. With that, Pete, I will say adios to all the listeners and give you the final word.
Psychologically speaking, vengeance rarely brings the catharsis we hope for.